Good afternoon, Montreal. It is 2:07, so we're a little late getting started with Movement Museum today, and I'm back. It's Allison Burns here with J.D. Papillon, and we're doing a little mix-up. I took last week off, and now Jen's taking this week off, so there you go. But you're left in very capable hands here on CKUT 90.3 FM. If you want to hear more Movement Museum, go to movementmuseum.com. You can listen to our past episodes. You can comment on our blog. You can follow us on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. You can download our podcast off iTunes. And you can email us at movement@ckut.ca. If you have any comments about the show, if you want to get involved, if you want to go on air, anything like that. So let's get started with what we got today. We're going to, a little later on in the show, we're going to do a tag team review, JD and I, of Manuel Roch's piece from a few weeks ago, because it's always fun when you get JD and I kind of at odds. We have very different tastes in dance. So that's something to look forward to in the second half of the show. But in the first half, we're going to get started with an interview.
Our guest this week is Adam Kinner. Some of you might already know Adam. He's been involved in the dance scene for about a year. And Adam right now is doing quite a few different things, so it will be interesting to see all that he's doing, where he's coming from, his perspective of dance also. So I'll let him introduce himself. So hi, Adam. How are you doing?
Hi, JD. I'm fine.
So tell us a bit about yourself, like how, because you're not from Montreal originally, you came to us from the States.
Yeah.
And what brought your move to Montreal? Like how did that all, how did the magic begin?
The magic. I grew up in Washington, D.C. I grew up playing saxophone, playing jazz saxophone. And then I moved here to go to school 10 years ago. Wow. It's a long time now. And I went to school and then I was a musician and everything was cool. And then all of a sudden, well, not really all of a sudden, it was more like for many years in the making, I just got kind of more drawn towards dance and sort of the activities around dance, like a very wide perspective on dance, but dance nonetheless, and just like became closer and closer to it and started meeting people in the dance scene and also working as a musician for dancers.
Was that your initial introduction? It was accompanying dancers?
Actually, my initial introduction was the FIND Festival, the Festival International de Nouveau Danse. And so I guess that ended in like 2005, but in 2003... I think it was 2003, I saw Alibi by Meg Stewart, and I was like totally blown away by it. Just, whoa, what is this?
I love hearing what are people's, you know, the one piece that kind of changed the course of their life.
There was that, and then there was also, and then, you know, wow, this, it was so exciting, this piece, and it lived with me for so long, like so ripe in my consciousness. And then I went back and saw Love, Forgeries, and Other Matters, which is a piece with Meg Stewart, Benoit Lachaume, and Han Ro, which is interesting now because we were just talking about Snakeskin, which is another show that's happening with Benoit Lachaume and Han Ro this week or next week. And then also I went to, I for a while I was very close with a friend from Canada at PARTS, which is a school for movement research in Brussels that Anna-Theresa de Kerstmacher runs. And yeah, my experience there, I went to visit my friend and it was very powerful. Just
who's your friend, by the way?
My friend's Liz Kenoshta. Okay. Do you know her? She's from Toronto.
I don't, is she still in the Montreal dance scene?
No, she never really was. She grew up in Toronto and then went to school in Brussels. And she still lives ostensibly in Brussels. She's always traveling around, but
PARTS is it's an interesting step in your development, I feel, because, I don't know, for me and for quite a few people I know, PARTS is this sort of holy grail of dance training. Like, you know, and Theresa the Cursemaker carries a really strong tradition, and, you know, she's sort of this mythic figure. Hmm. How is it to spend some time at PARTS?
Well, it's funny. Yeah, like, it's just, it's so funny to be an outsider in this scene, because I went to PARTS being like, oh, I'm going to visit my friend. You know, and it was like, this is an awesome school, this is great, but I have none of that baggage of like, this is a holy institution that's like, you know, built on blood and sweat. And like, it was just this refreshing thing, and I was meeting people and having a great time. I was there when they were having showings, which was just so cool, like meeting all these people for a couple of weeks and getting to know them, and then seeing these showings. It was like super awesome. And I was also at, in school at the same time. I was at McGill studying music, and like the contrast between that type of training, which seemed to me so open and so creative and so like about your own process and not about material, and my training at McGill, like it just kind of, not that my training was bad, but it was so different, and I started to kind of long for the other, the more parts type of learning.
And why McGill? I mean, I find it interesting because I've known a lot of people at the McGill Music School, Schulich, right?
Yeah.
And it's a very strict regimen, from what I've heard. It's, were you doing composing? Were you doing just performance?
I was studying like performance totally. But when you study jazz performance, you're sort of expected to be a composer also. That's just like a tradition of jazz. It's sort of like in dance where everyone's kind of a dancer and a choreographer in a way, or they're like, could be. It is rigorous. I mean, the world of music training is a really different world. It's much more, it's much more about like conservatory mentality. Like it's much more, I mean, it's kind of a more like ballet in dance. Like you're learning these techniques and you're like, it's like, you know, people are kind of breathing down your back. Like, can you play these chords in a row? Like, can you play really fast? and it's great. I mean, that's something that's like, it's a powerful way to learn too. I think it's just, for me, it was really necessary to kind of go out of that too. And not to say that there's so much creativity happening at McGill, happening in like jazz and music conservatories all around. Like there's so much, but I think sometimes that like it's not super sanctioned by the conservatory itself. Like conservatories tend to be rather conservative, and like I met a lot of people at McGill that were super interesting, and even the individual faculty members, but the program itself was like very, I'm making chopping motions on the table.
And now you're back in school, basically. You're at Concordia doing a master's degree.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat different from the BA you did. Now it's in BMUS. Now it's in performing arts. Can you tell us a bit more about the program? Because it's a pretty new program. I think it's been on for like 2 years now.
Yeah, I don't know the precise history of the program. I think it's a little longer than that. Maybe like 5 or 4. It was called the SIP. That was what I actually applied for. But now it's called INDI, I-N-D-I. It's a really cool program. It's at Concordia. And you just propose an interdisciplinary like research proposal for a master's or a doctorate or a postdoc. And you develop a curriculum with supervisors. You approach people at the school to like decide what classes you're going to take and work with these experts in the field. And then you write this proposal and then you can kind of do whatever. And the idea is that it's all connected, but you can really do anything. It's great.
Do you get to meet people that you could collaborate with potentially, or are you kind of left on your own student-wise? Like you have your relationship with your mentors, with your professors, but is there a lot of interconnectedness between the people taking the program?
I can't really speak to that because I think I'm like an exceptional case in that I think just because, well, yeah, I kind of went to the school not really needing that. So I don't have it. Like it's not, I don't really know anybody else doing this program. I've certainly had opportunities to meet them and I just haven't really been able to, or I've only been there a month also, but yeah, it's not really one of the things that I need from it, but I'm meeting people in my classes. I mean, I'm meeting you, like where, there are really interesting students and other professors that I'm taking. And then also, with KG, who's, we're in a class together, listeners.
KG Gutman, yeah. Who's one of our professors at Concordia, is teaching choreography 3 to both me and Adam right now, just to let the audience understand a bit better.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's an interesting program. Like, how are you approaching it? You're bringing your music background, you're bringing a bit of dance. How, you know, how's that going?
Yeah, how is it going? Good question. It's going well. I'm studying, originally the idea was to sort of study like the performance of music. But I think now it's just, I'm making sort of like interdisciplinary work that is based on my experience with music, my experience with movement and the body, and my experience with text. So that those are sort of the three points of like the interdisciplinary triangle, so to speak. And yeah, I mean, so far so good. I've only been there a little while.
Do you mind if I ask you a bit about Danse Boussonnier?
Boussonnier, yeah, no problem, yeah.
So you're the self-taught. You're the exception this year.
The exception to the rule, yeah. I think everyone else is from LADMI, or no, maybe not everyone.
Quite a few people are from LADMI. There's one person who's going to be from Quebec.
Yeah, and then Kim, I don't think, went to LADMI. Kim DeJong. Kimberly DeJong. She's also showing.
I don't know where she studied. I know that there is a strong majority from LADMI this year.
I'm the only guy who is self-taught. I'm not really even self-taught. I'm just like doing it. I don't know. I'm really happy to be performing at Tanchant in the thing, in Danse Boussonnière, which translates to roughly to like new waves. It doesn't really translate that way, but it is translated that way. Choreographer, short pieces. Yeah. And I'm just showing something that I made first in a Ivo Dimchev workshop.
All right. So what is the project that you proposed?
So it's called I'm Faking It. And what is the project? It's a solo for me. It's a lot of talking. The idea is that we're always faking it a bit, especially when you talk about time. So I say one of the central like sort of ideas in the piece is like when you say to someone that you love them, and you say that you love them forever, which is common in our society, you're like getting contractually obligated to fake it when you don't, or a little bit, I mean, to a lesser or greater extent. And I feel like I'm saying these like broad things about like love and relationships, and I don't mean to, but maybe you can just give me the benefit of the doubt. And so in performance, the idea of faking it is really interesting and really like sort of loaded. Like when you're someone's on stage, even if they're faking it, they're kind of like, the idea is that you just fake it and it's good. And like you fake your way into like it being real,
or fake it till you make it,
fake it till you make it. Totally. And like, where's authenticity in that? And I guess so those are the sort of the questions, some of the central questions of the piece. And then the other thing that I'm really interested in terms of faking it is the way that money also plays a role in faking things. Like, I feel that decisions are not really made until there's like money involved. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, as an artist, I mean, I feel that this questioning of money and the place of money in performance is quite essential right now, with grants being, you know, kind of hard to get. Mm-hmm. And especially the kind of government we have, which there's a fear of doing projects that will be approved for grants. So like, how can you keep your artistic integrity?
Totally.
And I mean, it's an interesting question though. This idea of performativity in everyday life. Do you feel that you're always performing, like when you're with people? Do you feel that there's ever any authentic moments in your life that you could really pinpoint?
That's such an interesting question. There are, yeah, totally. They're totally authentic moments, and I think in everybody's life. I think that the, even you could say the majority of them are, especially like private moments. But yeah, when performance gets in there, it gets a lot more complicated. I think in terms of like what you asked if I'm always performing, I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe a little bit, but I do come from a place like. One of my original reasons for wanting to dance was that I really felt when I was performing as a musician that the idea often of musicians sort of like, I'm not really on stage, like I'm not really in my body when I'm performing, I'm just like this vehicle of like music making. It was really like interesting and problematic for me, and like, okay, so you aren't performing. You're not going to think at all about what this looks like or like what you're doing with your body while you're performing. It's just like this, you're like this creature that's exuding music, you know, like that's so weird. Like you're totally performing, and that's where, you know, everyone's watching, like everyone's seeing. And so I guess I came into dance sort of being like, well, I've been a dancer for many years as a musician. Like I've just been on stage in my body, like moving and doing things.
I'd like to go back to when you said dance, you visually indicated quote unquote. Yeah. What's dance for you, Adam Kinner?
Oh, good
Talk
question.
To us about that.
Well, I mean, I don't come from a dance background. So I don't. So, yes. Yeah, so what do I mean to say? There's a lot of like things that people take for granted in the dance world where they're like, we'll just do one of these like ballet moves that we all know. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And so sometimes for me, like the idea for me of being like, I'm a dancer. Hi, my name is Adam. I'm a dancer. You know, it's like, it's sometimes I feel like, what do I get from that? And can I really call myself that? Like, is that weird? Is that weird for you guys? Like, cause you're presumably like trained dancers. I mean, I know that you were super trained and like, yeah, how like where do I fit? I don't know. And it's fine. Like I'm in some ways I kind of appreciate being an outsider in the dance world, and like when I went to parts and I was just like, this is fun, like let's all hang out. And I feel like it lets me be a little lighter about it all.
I think everyone should consider themselves a dancer.
Yeah, there you go. Totally. Everyone's a dancer.
I mean, movement.
We all move.
It's yeah. Like at Tangent, they've moved away from using the term dance. Mm-hmm. And their full name is Tangent Scène de Mouvement Contemporain. Yeah. So rather than saying contemporary dancer, saying contemporary movement, which
totally.
Kind of like what you were saying about this musician performing on stage. You know, every movement has traces of dance in it, mm-hmm. whether it's choreographed or not. And it's interesting. The Montreal scene seems to really be evolving in towards that wider range
totally.
of what's acceptable as quote-unquote dance.
Yeah.
I also think on a promotional level, it doesn't help us to create a us versus them mentality.
Totally.
We have these skills and you don't, so you sit there and you watch us do this, and it really alienates people, and that's not what it's about. It's about having a visceral reaction. It's about feeling empathetic towards the performance most of the time, you know? You want your audience involved.
Do you guys think, though, that it could also go the other way and alienate dancers from going to see shows which are not traditional dance shows? I mean, like, there's quite a few pieces which could be codified more as performance art, which are presented in traditional dance spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a risk of a backlash from more traditional dancers in that regard?
I always argue that I think we need to categorize further. I know there's a counter argument for sure, and we've had this conversation with George Stamos, which was really exciting. But because I think different people like different things, obviously, and contemporary dance is such a wide spectrum. If you get somebody who have never seen a contemporary dance show, they go see something on one end of the spectrum, they don't enjoy it, they never go again. Whereas, you know, perhaps what's on the other end of the spectrum, perhaps the more neoclassical kind of is right up their alley, but what they saw was, you know, somebody throwing paint everywhere, and it's so they're upset, and they didn't see what they came to see and what they could have enjoyed. So I really think that we should categorize further the genre of contemporary dance. I think it's too broad, personally, and I think that's how you get people enjoying the shows that they want to see or seeing the shows that they will enjoy.
Yeah, I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, how would you feel if a contemporary choreographer approached you and said, Adam, you do not have the typical or typical, again, quote unquote, type of training of most dancers, but I love your physicality. But I want to use that physicality to make it something that is not natural, which would be very balletic moves. How would you react to having to undertake something like this?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think as long as I was interested in what the choreographer... I mean, I think if someone... I don't know. I think if someone, like, asked me to do something like that, yeah, I would be interested. Sure. I mean, part of me is very interested in, like, dance... proper, you know, for lack of a better way of talking about it. Yeah, but I just don't know if that'll ever happen.
You're also a musician, as we've mentioned already. I'd like for us right now to play one of your songs.
Sure.
And we'll come back after the song. Could you tell us a bit about this song called Secret Code?
Oh yeah, okay. This song It's just a little song. It's like, I made it, I think it was a while ago, and my friends came and played a little. It was just, I had this beautiful studio and I wanted to do something. And that's it. It's not super connected to the rest of my life, but it's still a nice song.
All right. Here's Secret Code by Adam Kinner. We'll see you after.
I've been waiting for too long. Just to say that I love you. Sounds so
Wonderful.
So this was Secret Code by Adam Kinner, our guest for today. Before the break, we were talking about many, many things. We were talking about what it's like for someone not coming from a traditional dance background to get into this dancing in Montreal, and the difference between dance, movement, things like that, which was very interesting. If you missed it, make sure to listen to the podcast. And we still have Adam with us in the studio. We were talking during the break about one of the people who got you into dancing in the first place. Would you like to tell us a bit more about how that came about?
Yeah, maybe not in the first place, more like in the most,
second place,
yeah,
in third,
like the
place.
Third place, but like super super awesome place. Yeah, Kelly Keenan, who probably, I think, is she teaching you?
She's actually teaching me right now.
That's awesome. Kelly Keenan, I met her through a friend, and I knew she was a dancer, and one day we had this amazing meeting. One day she was biking down the park hill, and I was like walking by, and I ran into her, and it was last year around this time maybe, and I said, Kelly, hey. We kind of knew each other, and I was like, hey, I really want to dance. And she was like, oh, okay. And then she just like biked away, and she was like, I'll be in touch. And then a few weeks later, she was like, I have studio time, like come into the studio. And it was so cool. We really, yeah, she really helped to kind of just be like, yeah, just dance. It's like, you're already a dancer, do it. And yeah, and that started a project that kind of has been going for a long time. And in the summer with another dancer, Alana Kreischveld, we all went to Berlin and took a workshop with Mike Stewart, which was like totally also coming like all the way around again for me, because Mike's work had been so important in like the very beginning of me being interested in dance. So that was amazing. Mike Stewart, awesome lady. If you don't know her work, check it out. It's like super powerful. And yeah.
I like your story.
Everyone's just nodding.
Yeah, it's a good story.
Yeah, I want to dance. Okay, yeah. Let's make that happen.
Yeah, totally. And she still is. Now we're kind of continuing to work on this project that is very slow moving, but like super strong. So it's fun.
And which direction is that project taking?
One of the, I guess, yeah, the focus in a way of the project is vulnerability and like the politics, the physicality, the embodiment, the issues surrounding vulnerability, and something we're both super interested in. And yeah, right now it's just kind of a big discursive like workshop. We have a million ideas that we've like documented and videoed, and we're just working. we go into the studio, I guess in the fall we'll be in there like once a week or twice a week. And yeah.
That's interesting, vulnerability, because I've seen pictures that Kelly has taken. I mean, I think it's that Kelly Keenan of Lost Mittens.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It's her, right? Okay, because yeah. I just like bumped into one of those someday, and I was like, you know, that's interesting, because there is something very vulnerable about those images of just... Yeah. Single mittens lost, you know, in the urban landscape. What would be your, like, how would you represent your vulnerability? Like, if you had to choose one image.
There's so many ways, but, and they're all, like, they can all be really not vulnerable too. That's, like, the interesting thing about vulnerability. But a lot of times when I think of vulnerable performances, like, one of the sort of touchstones is this man called Eric Chenault. I know I'm just like I'm like sort of passing off the question, but Eric Chenault is a musician, a guitarist and singer who actually works with Amy Henderson, the Toronto choreographer. And his music, the way he sings, the way he like is just sitting on stage, like super still and frontal, and the words and the singing is like this image of vulnerability to me. A really strong vulnerability, like a very like settled, strong vulnerability, but vulnerable nonetheless.
So there's some aspect of just giving yourself up, I guess, in a way, like in this type of performance, which I guess represents vulnerability to you.
Yeah, well, I think it's also like the conversation around vulnerability, like what strength comes from vulnerability and what strength do you give up to achieve vulnerability. I also have a hunch that like vulnerability is sort of in a way the essence of a connection between people. Like I think that that's that you can kind of find like soul or spirit in vulnerability too. And I'm also interested in like where vulnerability is sanctioned and where it's not. Like one of the things Kelly and I have worked a lot with is like confessions and confessional modes, which is like a place where society like sanctions vulnerability. Like we say, yeah, you're supposed to be vulnerable. You're supposed to like kind of get on your knees here and like, and then, but otherwise like don't do that. yeah, there's just like all these questions and they're really interesting for me around vulnerability.
I find this interesting to see like of the two projects, main projects that you're working on that you've talked to us about today, they go to sort of two different ends of the spectrum. There's this performativity, which would be sort of the opposite, I feel, of vulnerability, or at least putting a sort of wall that protects your opening up, and vulnerability, which is the opposite of just like sort of giving away from yourself. You know, how do you approach these two, like jumping from one point to the other like that? Or do you feel that quite the opposite, they're really close on the spectrum?
I think they're really close. I think that you're right, and that they're, well, one of the projects is still like, it's sort of totality is still informed and the other one is very formed. But I think, yeah, they're just like two sides of sort of the same coin. The structure of the solo is set, and there is a wall in a way, but it's a wall that like also gives way. And I think it's like the sort of perspectives of that wall and like the distance of the performer is what like kind of gives it traction. So yeah, it's not invulnerable. It's not like super set in its like strength, you know, it's open and confusing. It's confusing in a good way.
It's now 22. So we're going to play a second song by Adam Kinner. This one is called I Can See Your Face. Do you want to give again two little words about that song?
Yeah, this song is, well, I play solo saxophone sometimes, and this is one of the songs that I sometimes play, and it's all saxophones on the recording. It's just me in a room with a loop pedal and some effects and stuff.
Great. So it's I Can See Your Face. Thank you so much for coming on the show today with us, Adam.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Movement Museum here on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is currently 2:46, and we finished our interview with Adam Kinner, but because he likes us so much, he's sticking around in studio. And the track just before that ad there was one of his, a looping pedal and a saxophone, really interesting stuff. Yeah. But we're going to move away from Adam Kinner now, and as promised, we're going to get to our tag team review of Manuel Rock's Ne meurs pas tout de suite, on le regarde.
Is it going to be so much a tag team, or is it more going to be a confrontation, a fight?
Well, in the notes I put review slash debate.
Good, that's a good way to put it, I feel.
We've learned that JD and I have very different tastes in dance and often have different opinions on it. So.
Especially for a show like Manuel Rocks, I feel, because it's the type of thing, and I mean, like, I feel that if we hadn't had Manuel on the show to discuss the piece before, my reaction might have been really different. I mean, just to put people into context for those who haven't seen it, it's an hour-long show with two performers, two dancers, Manuel Rock and Lucie Vigneault, in this space filled with balloons. They're both wearing paper crowns on their heads. There's like cheap plastic chairs. And, you know, it's basically this post-apocalyptic moment, the way you described it, and it's the last two human beings on Earth.
Yeah, he said a post-apocalyptic Adam and Eve was in the description.
Which is really poetic, I feel.
Poetic, but I think inaccurate.
How so?
Well, first of all, I don't see a romantic tie between the two of them whatsoever.
Do you think that Adam and Eve were actually romantic?
Well, didn't they, you know, start populating the Earth?
Yeah, but there's a difference between breeding and being romantic, though. I feel that quite the opposite. The Adam and Eve theme or way to name them is strong because there's this... What happens after, you know, we've done it? What happens after, you know, we've said everything we had to say, we've done everything we had to do together, but we're just left there together?
Yeah.
And there was this sort of ennui and this desire to be seen or acknowledged by the other, which was very present.
For sure, yeah. The initial tableau, which sustains itself after everyone sat down and settled in and the lights go down, they stay there in their chairs, kind of lazily blowing up balloons, and they just look like the king and queen of a world that they don't know what to do with anymore. They're just
boredom.
Bored.
Just insane.
Absolutely.
Boredom.
And what unfolds in the next hour is them entertaining themselves, trying to, a lot of it is about grasping the attention of the other or just being louder, bigger than. And it's very childish. And in that sense, I feel like it's brother and sister, the relationship, more so than lovers. They don't have the maturity of lovers, you know?
But at the same time, I feel that there was this kind of ennui that you could see in really old couples, you know, senior citizen couples, of just, you know what, I'm just fed up with hearing you. Like, you know what? It was fun. Your jokes were funny 20 years ago. But now just give me a break. I'm trying to eat my hard candy. And I feel that a lot of the show was built on this tension of, you know, just imagining what came before, which was so, like, living and powerful and, like, a strong relationship. But what was left was just this hubris. Is that proper? Just like this, you know, everything left, like it was the garbage of what used to be. It was the foundations just after they crumbled, after the building crumbled. And I feel that it gave such weight to the piece, just this unsaid relationship that could have evolved to this. And it was really sad in a way.
That's an interesting perspective. I definitely took it from the younger kind of wide-eyed, curious child that's attention-starved and prone to throwing tantrums.
That's just like my grandpa, though.
Yeah,
in a way.
But it's also the stripping of everything. It's because it's kind of back to basic wants and needs and really basic modes of getting what you want and you need. It's not about manipulation or more complex interaction. It's very stripped down.
But I mean, if you think about it, this context of it's this post-apocalyptic society has crumbled moment, where those social rules of, you know, doing something that's calculating, that's almost manipulative, doesn't really have a point anymore when it's just the two of you and who cares what anyone else thinks. And I feel that in this challenge, Manuel Hawk has really created a piece that stands on its own very strongly, because, you know, I didn't feel at any point that he cared what the audience thought. And he mentioned when he was on the show with us that a lot of the creation came from authentic movement. So finding really just the what's brewing inside. And I feel that that's part of why. I mean, I always have a hard time in a piece when people just start yelling and throwing things around. But in the case of this piece, which, you know, is something that they do at some points, it felt like it had its place. It wasn't just, I'm going to start yelling loudly and making weird noises to amuse the audience, but more because this is where I'm coming from with this, it fits. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Something else he was talking about was that a friend of his had just had kids, and he was observing them in research for the piece, and they really did capture a lot of moments where it's like, that's exactly it. That's the exact way that this child would stand in front of the microphone, lip syncing without moving her lips, and just kind of posing as if for like a little mirror. Just it's very delicate moments, and in the tantrums as well, just like really kind of capturing that emotion and going through it. And I do appreciate that, and I think it was done well. I just think I could have done with about 80% less screaming. Honestly, I think he got that point across the first time he threw a tantrum. I think there were like 4 or 5 tantrums.
Oh, at least.
In the piece.
At least. Even Lucy Vigneault went through her own tantrums. Not as much as Manuel Hawk did, but hers were, you know, ferocious, if
yeah,
you will.
They all were.
And I mean that in the best way of the term.
To their credit, they went to the top, the end, every single time.
Oh, they pushed
but
it
I don't
as
understand
far as they could take it, I feel.
Why did they have to go there so many times? I was sitting up front, right by the speaker. It was kind of brutal.
See, that's the thing, though. I was sitting all the way to the back, and I could actually see your face and looked at your expression quite often during the show to see how you would react to it. And I feel that this, actually, from my perspective, looking at the audience reaction, was really interesting. Because in a show like that, even though the audience is, for most of it, totally ignored, they are still so implicated. I mean, just the act of being a patient audience and the way he asks us to just go along with it, even though it's not an easy show to see, even though there are some really, truly funny moments and there are some really
absolutely
heartbreaking moments too.
There's laugh out loud moments in the work and really some solid physical humor.
And it didn't feel like it was calculated laughs either. It didn't feel
I felt it was.
You felt? I felt that it just came from a place where I don't think that they had ideas at this moment we're going to try to make people laugh. Do you see what I mean? I didn't feel that it was, okay, we're going to throw this in to make people laugh. I felt that it was just, it came from this place where they felt that this is what they had to do at that time. And
I think they were researching this playfulness, and that's where the humor comes from. I don't think they were unexpected laughs.
Maybe not unexpected, but I would say uncalculated in a way where, you know, I hate
lines.
When they try. Yeah, exactly. I hate when people try to make me laugh just for the sake of it. I like when people come up with stuff that will just make me laugh. And I feel that that's a challenge that I go through quite often, seeing shows where people say or think, you know, humor is going to be great here. It feels fake so often. Mm-hmm. And I felt that in this show, I didn't have that knee-jerk reaction.
Right. It was more like they were reaching this kind of global understanding on certain things, and that's what people reacted to. It wasn't dumb humor. It was pretty deep. But on the note of audience participation and interaction, there is audience interaction.
There is, and actually, that's what I wanted to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I was going to say, I think that's a contradiction again to the post-apocalyptic Adam and Eve. Wouldn't they be alone in the world? but they acknowledge us.
Maybe
a few times.
Maybe the creators are saying, and especially with the type of questions that they were asking the audience, I feel, because they went up to the to some audience members. They went, actually, it was just Lucie Vigneault who went to people and asked the question, do you feel truly happy? Or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And there is such like a heartbreaking quality to a question like that.
And what percentage of the time?
Oh, yeah.
Feel
and
good?
It's like, I mean, if I'd been honest and if I'd answered, I would probably have said, not really.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that there was this awkwardness, this discomfort in people who, one audience participant said that, yes, she was truly happy. But this felt calculated, you know? And I feel that this was one of the interesting things where are we actually living this post-apocalyptic moment where we're surrounded by boredom and trying to put on nice airs and, you know, I don't know. I felt that this audience participation actually brought us or brought this post-apocalyptic environment into the present rather than take us out of that moment that it brought us into.
Rather than saying that this is a representation of what will be, they're saying this is.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
What bothered me about that particular audience interaction is that Lucie comes out and speaks like a grown-up.
Mm-hmm.
And she interacts with the audience like an adult. And that broke kind of this character for me. I think it was inconsistent, again, with kind of this really childish, honest, no airs type character.
So I feel that this was necessary. If she had come up to the audience and said, oh, do you feel you're happy right now? And started screaming in their ears, I felt that the power of that moment wouldn't have stuck as much.
I'm not necessarily suggesting that as the solution. I like maybe somebody else comes out and says it, or maybe it's a voiceover because I have a few voiceovers. Or maybe she doesn't
do
it at all.
Godlike. I mean, with the context, like you hear this voice coming from above, it's like God. You know, and I don't know. I feel that this. I don't know. I don't
have the solution. I'm just pointing out the problem. Let's say that.
I liked it though. I like that she switched to this very almost TV presenter voice of, so tell us, how do you feel about being happy right now? You know, there was something so fake about it. And I think that's pretty much. So
I'm
going to finish it with this.
I'm sure we could talk about that forever, but we have run out of time. But you're going to finish right there? We're good?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, so that was a little taste of what JD and I thought of Ne meurs pas tout de suite, on nous regarde by Manuel Roque. We had him in studio a couple weeks ago, so you can go to movementmuseum.com and listen to our past interview with him. I also have a review of it up on Bloody Underrated, which is a great blog that I often contribute to, so you can go check it out there if you want more information. The show is no longer running, unfortunately, but there you go.
There's also your review of the show I reviewed last week,
Right.
Solo by Daniel Leveillé.
That's right. Absolutely. So you can either listen to last week's episode to hear JD's version, or you can go to Bloody Underrated and read my version of what we thought of that show.
Do
and
we
compare
have time
and contrast.
To quickly mention that it's almost done for the Bouche DC applications?
Of course. Monday is the last day at 6 p.m. So get your applications in for Bouche DC's 2013 Common Space. And thanks for the reminder, JD. We'll see you all next week. For Movement Museum, I'm Allison Burns with JD Papillon. Bye-bye.